another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamparo, naturopathic physician, author, and many things natural, and really excited to be here this morning. Dr. Kamai, the natural nurse, has the week off, and I love when I delve into a really great topic with one of my superstar students who is now a esteemed practitioner. That's kind of one of my callings in life, is to train the next generation of natural practitioners. So we have, like Progressive Radio Network says, we're moving forward, you know, not looking back. And so we have Dr. Marley Saxman on as a naturopathic doctor who provides health care through infants and geriatric populations at her clinic, the Maine Natural Medicine Clinic. And she's really does a lot of work with empowering health and embracing lifestyle, diet, nutrition, supplementation. She has training and experience in nutrition, botanical medicine, homeopathy, environmental medicine, ozone therapy, brain health, healthy aging. I know she worked in her previous life before becoming a naturopathic physician with lots of children with special needs, and still does. And so we look forward to having her on and talking about some interesting chronic inflammatory response syndrome, or what they call CIRS, C-I-R-S. Hey, Marley, how are you?
I'm great, Dr. Z. It's so good to hear your voice.
Wow, it's great to have you on. This is a long time coming. I try to have inventive minds on and naturopathic physicians who are doing some interesting work. So that's why I've been wanting to have you on for a while, and I'm glad we made it happen there. So
well,
now I know you chose naturopathic medicine as a second career. Let's talk about a little about your background and what drew you into the field.
Sure, thanks. I actually practiced as a speech-language pathologist for 25-plus years before I chose to embark on this venture to become a naturopathic doctor. My youngest was going off to get her master's degree, and I decided I needed to do the next thing. And that happened as a result. I ended up specializing in working with children in the autistic spectrum. And what I found with those kiddos was that the more I could work with their families to venture into things like looking at their gut health, that we could actually make some significant changes in their brain inflammation, their neuroinflammation, and kind of help their immune systems. And as they started to feel better physically, they were more able to take advantage of some of these special purpose programs and therapies that I was involved in, and that was really exciting to see.
Interesting, yeah. That's kind of, and then so you decided to go to the University of Bridgeport, which is a burgeoning college of naturopathic medicine on the East Coast, accredited. And And did you have a good program there pretty much for the most part, you know, ups and downs and things like that? I know you were a transfer student from one of the other colleges and ended up on the East Coast.
You know, that's true, and I have no problem, excuse me, giving UB just a great plug. I actually, because I'm from Maine and I was tired of the winter, when it came time to make the decision about going to school, I just thought, you know what, I'm going to Arizona where there's sunshine, and I really didn't necessarily do all the research I could have or should have done. And I went out to Southwest College of Naturopathic Medicine for my first year, and I was really struggling there, as was Southwest College, because they were going through some very unpleasant curriculum changes. They actually lost a number of students during that time frame, and I believe they've changed their curriculum as a result of that. But I have to tell you, at that point, I was pretty savvy, and I went around and I looked at all the other naturopathic schools. I took the time to go and look at all the rest of the schools, and by far, I was the most impressed with what I saw right back in New England happening in Bridgeport. I right from the get-go with the interviews and being welcomed as a transfer student and really feeling that I was getting a very solid and traditional education in naturopathic medicine. And I have to tell you, It's overwhelming being a medical student, especially as a second career. And so many times I sat there thinking, I'm never going to remember this, and this is all foolish, and why are we doing this? And I can't tell you, every day as I sit here with my patients, like, there it is. That's one of those things Dr. Z taught me, or there's one of those things I learned. So,
thanks.
You know, and I keep thinking I should write the dean and tell her to share that with the students, that the educational process, although really difficult and overwhelming, it works. It was a great program. I passed my boards first time around,
right.
I'm only a year out, and I have a thriving, successful practice, and it's all thanks to the wonderful education I got at UB. So thank you,
Dr. Z. That's wonderful. To hear that, great. Right.
Yeah.
So now, how do you, what's happened since you've been out there and graduating? Do you tend to gravitate towards the population as a naturopathic doctor? Well, first of all, where are you in Maine? Is it real rural Maine, or is it on the coast Maine, or where are you in Maine?
I am in both. I'm on the
okay.
coast, and it's pretty rural. So you think of the coast of Maine, and as you venture up from Massachusetts, you know, Portland would be our big city in the southern part of the state. And I'm a couple hours up the coast, very near Acadia National Park in Bar Harbor.
Wow.
I'm actually from Bar Harbor and MDI, Mount Desert Island. So I'm sitting about 20 to 30 minutes from that location in Ellsworth.
Oh.
And small, you know, it's a small rural area. We have a tremendous influx in the summer, you know, so
right.
there's a lot of people. And honestly, for a small community, there was already a naturopath here.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an interesting choice to choose to kind of, you know, try to put down roots here. There were 30 naturopaths in the state of Maine when I came, and I think we may now have something like 32. So for a small state, you know, that's not too bad. And Maine has been licensed. I think we just celebrated our 20th year of licensure for naturopathic doctors in the state of Maine. So
wow.
That's really cool. I imagined all through med school, and it was my intention in coming back to the Ellsworth area because I did work here in Hancock County, Maine as a speech-language pathologist in a number of different settings. I had anticipated that I would carry on my specialty work with children with special needs and children in the spectrum, in the autistic spectrum, because there's such a need for that. And that's what I thought was going to happen, but things have not quite unfolded that way.
Okay. Well, that's interesting. There's always that, you know, whatever the universe plans for us too. So,
yeah.
I know you've been working with this thing called chronic inflammatory response syndrome. Is that just an acronym for something old, something new, or something borrowed, something blue, like the old saying?
Yeah, exactly. Chronic inflammatory response syndrome, which is actually called SIRS, I believe that phrase was coined by Dr. Richie Shoemaker, who is an MD in Maryland, whose life's work has been in pursuit of understanding this very, very complex and all too frequently found diagnosis in people who are chronically ill. And interestingly enough, chronic inflammatory response syndrome is actually typically secondary to exposure in a water damaged building. And according to Dr. Shoemaker, 50% of the buildings in the United States are actually water damaged buildings, which is kind of staggering. I unfortunately believe where I live in down east Maine, where we have a lot of humidity, and this is, you know, these are older communities, I would dare to venture the numbers closer to 75 to 80% of the buildings here actually have some form of water damage.
Mm.
So I first had my own experience about 4 years ago after the hurricane in Connecticut when I was going to UB. My roommate and I rented a house at the beach.
Wow.
And we were concerned a little bit about water. There was a basement, and we went into the basement, and we were savvy enough that we knew we should have a mold company come in and take a look to be sure it was safe. And the you know, mold folks came in and said, you know, we think you're fine. Have the owners get anything out of the basement where mold could grow, which means things like cardboard and wood, plastic, metal. That's not a concern. Mold's not going to grow there. So we said, okay, and we talked to the owner, and they said, sure, we'll come in and clean it out. I think maybe they actually empowered us to clean it out, you know. So we got rid of anything that mold could grow on, and, you know, it was an older building, and there might have been a little dampness down there, but no overt mold or anything. And this would have been about my third year med school. And what happened was my roommate was upstairs and I was on the first floor and we were both getting really, really sick, but our symptoms were totally different. My roommate upstairs, Carolyn, who you know, was having symptoms more of like anxiety and depression. She just found like she was feeling more anxious than usual and more depressed. And I was starting to get upper respiratory symptoms and really bad headaches. And we had a hard time discerning what was really going on because, you know, med school is stressful, as you know. And we thought maybe that was it. And she actually had a heat vent over her head. I had a heat vent beside my bed. And we had a hot forced air heat system. And I was convinced after I got through my first round of boards that mine was all going to be stress and it was just going to get better and nothing happened, but it kept getting worse. And it was actually March when one Sunday we're sitting there and going, what are we going to do? Like, this is terrible, and I can't study, and I don't feel good. And it was like this epiphany went off, and we went, it's the house. We've got to get out of the house. And literally within that day, we were out of the house. We moved and contacted the owners of the home, and one of whom was a medical doctor, and they were not interested to hear what we had to say at all. We contacted a mold company. They contacted a mold company, and the mold was in the furnace. It was in the hot air furnace, and the house was very, very toxic. And we realized in hindsight we'd been fine. We moved in July. The house was open. We had the windows open, and we realized it wasn't until October when we closed the house up that we both started getting symptomatic.
So it was actually in the furnace where it's actually warm. I guess it could be warm and humid in the furnace too, but you would think that the heat would kill it. Is that
no?
Is that a misinterpretation of it? I guess so.
It is. I know. I thought the same thing. So mold actually does grow in a lot of moisture, but it also there are molds that grow in dry environments. And what's true is this particular furnace, the water damage from the hurricane had gotten into those soft aluminum pipes. There was actually water in the furnace, had gotten into the furnace. My understanding as I'm now venturing into this world quite deeply and being trained is that it's also not at all unusual to be in air conditioning units. Deep in the core of the air conditioning units, there will also be mold. So, and, you know, unfortunately, that was just my first exposure. It took me probably 6 months. I did a lot of work, a lot of health restoration. Ozone was part of that. Moved to Maine, you know, passed my second round of boards, moved to Maine, thought, okay, I'm going to start feeling great. This is good. I'm putting med school behind me. And I kept getting sicker and sicker and sicker. I had no idea what was going on, but my health was as challenged as it's ever been. And one day I rented a beautiful house here in the water. I mean, just a gorgeous new house, you know, beautiful. Ran down into the basement to throw in a load of laundry and came upstairs and I had a headache, a really bad instant headache. And I went, that's the kind of headache I used to get in Connecticut with a mold. And I went downstairs and I turned on a light in a very dark room and probably about 2 feet off the ground was a band of mold that was probably about a foot in width growing around the entire room.
Wow. Huh.
Yeah. Yeah,
serious Did you have the species of mold checked to see what it was?
The owner did that work and never released those reports to me, interestingly enough. And we attempted to do some restoration. But what happens when you have this sensitivity, which we should talk about, who those folks are, you get sicker quicker with each exposure. So what happens is, according to Dr. Shoemaker's research, and again, he's spent his life's, you know, efforts in researching this, 24% of the population have a genetic variation. We call those SNPs, a single nucleotide genetic polymorphism. And you know I was really interested in that in school, and I remain really interested in that. Yeah. It's called HLA, which stands for human leukocyte antigen. And, of course, I've tested positive for that. So I have this genetic polymorphism that renders my immune system very inept at identifying not only mold but the mycotoxins and eliminating them from my body.
Wow, so they actually know this SNP of subpopulations of patients and folks that would have this trouble.
Absolutely, Dr. Z. It's just incredible. We actually do a test. It's a very intensive process once we get to deciding someone's at the stage where we need to do the labs to diagnose the chronic inflammatory response syndrome. And one of those labs is a LabCorp where we send off a little lavender top tube to a LabCorp, and they type the HLA variants. So they do all the different haplotypes of HLA. And that takes me about a month to get that back. And once I get it back, it looks like a bunch of coding. You know, it's a bunch of numbers. It's a little complex to kind of wrap your brain around. They report on both DRB1, DQ, DRB3, DRB4, and this is getting very technical.
Yeah, and these are
genetic.
Kind of patterns. I know they're patterns that are associated with disease prevalence. Like, for instance, I know there's patterns associated with certainly autoimmunity and genetic predispositions to most things. These HLA, like HLA B27 and ankylosing spondylitis and DR4. And so that's it's a molecular pattern that kind of forms on your cells that then could look like something else, I guess, in a way.
Yeah. And it's, you know, I was a little concerned when I started venturing into this world whether I was going to be able to do the patterning, and someone has brilliantly put together a program. You just go in and type in HLA calculator. So you go into Google and you type in HLA calculator, and into the calculator it reports, you know, the different so it would be DRB, and then I can look at my LabCorp, and LabCorp tells me what variations of that DRB there are. So I enter the data, and I hit calculate, and it will tell me exactly what the vulnerability for that particular patient is. So it's very helpful in dealing with a population of folks who are dealing with, you know, pretty significant chronic illness. That I can come up, for example, my result showed that I was multiply chemically sensitive. And some folks will come up that they're mold, you know, that mold is the issue for them. Some of them will come up with chronic fatigue, fibromyalgia, MS, chronic Lyme. So there's a certain haplotype or certain subset of HLA that are the folks that are ending up with the chronic Lyme. So it gives me a really good diagnostic tool right from the beginning, and also the great validation for the patient to see, look, you know, you're not crazy. This is what's going on. You have this genetic kind of baseline or predisposition that put you in a vulnerability, and now you've had, you know, it's that whole epigenetic. You had this genetic vulnerability. You've had this experience, either being exposed to the mycotoxin or the Lyme. And now, you know, things have been activated, and now we need to go to work and do our job.
Right. So you brought up a couple of points there, so that the person had some type of a predisposition. So in other words, it was like it was lucky for the organism, but unlucky for the patient that they landed at the right place and the right person, because that allowed that organism or toxin or whatever to do damage to the patient, and the body didn't have the ability to sequester and get rid of it in the myriad ways that our body gets rid of toxins or microorganisms or things like that, you're saying, basically.
Absolutely, Dr. Z, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Again, according to Dr. Shoemaker, 24% of the population, you know, 76% of the population in their innate immune system, the HLA, which stands for human leukocyte antigen, is the arm of the immune system that's differentiating really on some level between self and other. Is this me, mm-hmm. or is this something that I need to work on eliminating from the body? And those of us that have this HLA variation, that very, you know, primary and initial part of the immune system, which we label innate immunity, is not working well. So what happens, the things that should be being recognized for elimination and eliminated, you know, properly, and 76% of the population is doing that, 24% of us aren't able to do that. So these biotoxins and then the mycotoxins from them, you know, all the toxins they're creating, end up getting in our bile and being circulated and recirculated and recirculated in our fat and in our bile.
Wow. So that creates this inability of the patient to get rid of this thing, and then the chronic symptoms happen. Does mainstream medicine, I mean, these folks are like the people that aren't getting well, and mainstream medicine just kind of shrugs their shoulders and says, I don't know what to do with you, or it's all in your head. Is that what you've seen?
It's funny when you say, yes, and it's interesting when you say that to me, because I had a patient yesterday sit on the other side of my desk, and she was embarrassed to say it, but she said, you know, I'm kind of here because I'm desperate. You know,
yeah,
as if that was going to be an insult to me. And I said, oh, no, we were trained in medical school that we would know that the people who find their way to us are people who have not been able to be, you know, well served by mainstream medicine or, you know, allopathic medicine. So
yeah, yeah.
I actually have a PowerPoint that I reviewed this morning in getting ready to speak with you that was presented at one of Dr. Lynch's conferences a year or so ago, where he was incorporating and talking about chronic inflammatory response. And it's a joke where, you know, the patient's in the bed and the doctor's coming in to review the results with him. You know, it's going to be a big moment. And the doc says to the patient, the bad news is you have mold toxicity. The good news is I don't believe in the disease, so you're fine.
It's kind of funny but sad in a way.
It is.
Oh, yes. No.
Yeah.
Yeah, and I know, like, they don't believe that, you know, Lyme can become an autoimmune disease, even though there's some pretty good preliminary papers on it, that's for sure. And by autoimmune, it means that, like, there's, again, the body is either... Well, you can explain it to them. So some of these things go on to form like autoimmunity, I guess, because the body has a hard time clearing the pathogen, or at some time it looks so much like the patient, the bug or whatever, that the immune system gets fooled into starting to attack the patient, even though the bug's not even there. So both scenarios, I know, happen. Do you encounter those types of things? I'm sure.
I absolutely do. One of the patterns that's been really clear to me from the beginning, which was staggering, is I believe Maine has unfortunately moved to the number one position for Lyme in the country.
Ooh.
We may have surpassed Connecticut at this
wow.
point. So, yeah, Lyme, and if you want to call it chronic Lyme, are a major, major problem here in down east Maine. And I'm dealing with patients with acute and chronic issues in relationship to, you know, tick bites and Lyme exposure every day. What I have found, though, that is fascinating to me is that, and I, you know, I want to say 100%, but I'll be conservative and say somewhere between 90 and 100% of my patients that I see who believe they have chronic Lyme and have either been diagnosed by another integrative practitioner with chronic Lyme or have been scorned by someone who doesn't believe in chronic Lyme is that, no, you just need to go on an antidepressant. They all have chronic inflammatory response syndrome. There seems to be some very strong pull between these mycotoxins and Lyme. So we certainly have the genetic consideration. We know we have a population. I lovingly and endearingly refer to my patients as the Canary Club. that.
Yeah, it's like the folks that seem to, you can use it. That analogy with a lot of people, that's kind of like the reason why they brought canaries down on coal mines, right?
Yeah.
They were the first ones to sort of drop.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that meant get out of the mine fast.
Right. Well, you know, I did a residency in Vermont and with Dr. Warnock, who was the first naturopath in the state of Vermont. Brilliant, brilliant man. And when he would do GNA interpretations with his patients and he would start running into some of these HLAs, he described it as those folks who had the mold variation. I mean, that, you know, we think genetically these things served a purpose in our evolution, right? Mm. And that we were the people that would go in to find the dwellings that were safe to take the tribes into, which I thought was fascinating.
Well, that's like, pretty interesting, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
Someone had to know it was a safe place to take a tribe into. And I am so sensitive, Dr. Z, that I'll share a little story. I put a patient on the scale one day, and I started getting dizzy standing next to her. And I said to her, we're just starting the visit. I'm weighing her, and I say, do you have any concerns that possibly there's mold growing in your house? And she whipped around and looked at me, and she said, how did you know? She said, I just wiped all the windows down in my house this morning, and the paper towels were covered with black.
Yeah, I mean, I could detect it. I had the same thing, you know, growing up in New York, we would always keep our bicycles down in the cellar in our apartment. And you know, that was a real moldy, dingy place. I remember my mom telling us the boogeyman was down there, so we wouldn't hang out down there. But, boy, I tell you, that was a toxic place, and it always bothered me going down there. And I know a lot of folks that are like that, where mold, they can detect mold on people's clothes, on their hair, based on storage of something. Like, I could smell it on a patient a mile away, too, and it does affect me as well, that's for sure. So, wow, that's...
So- You probably have the HLA variation.
There's no doubt. I mean, I know I've done some of my SNPs. Yeah, I have that Celtic blood, too, and half Italian, half Celtic. And, yeah, we need lots of folic acid. So what are some of the things that people can do about these things? You know, like here someone comes in, and no one's giving them hope, like antibiotics don't help them because it has to do with their ability to see the world and neutralize it, you know, see stuff and neutralize it. And then that's tied into our great, you know, naturopathic sayings like, you know, when in doubt, treat the liver and the gut and all these things that the old timers used to say that I passed on to you guys and you're passing on to the world. So, you know, so someone like that may need custom nutrition, I would assume, right? And things to make their body work as best as they can, considering the situation. Let's start with that, talk about a little bit about that, and then we'll take a break at 1:30 the hour, and then we'll talk about more stuff about
that. Okay, great. Well, I think you make an excellent point, and of course we always want to think about lifestyle and diet initially and address that. And we're dealing with inflammation. I mean, that comes right back to this whole concept of SIRS and chronic inflammatory response syndrome. And we know that our standard American diet, what we lovingly refer to as the SAD diet, tends to be a pro-inflammatory diet.
So
for sure, we want to be helping to educate our patients that we need to be very mindful of inflammation. And even stress is pro-inflammatory, exercise is pro-inflammatory, estrogen is pro-inflammatory. So depending on my patient and where they're at in their individual life and, you know, various things they may be dealing with, we certainly are doing everything we can to address inflammation, and diet is a big part of that.
Mm. Okay. Well, we'll take a quick break. Let the engineer cue something up there. And when we return, we're again talking with Dr. Morley Sackman, and she's a naturopathic physician in Maine, and we're talking about this really interesting chronic inflammatory response syndrome and reactions to mold and just reactions to the environment, the folks that are the canary in the coal mine. Researchers have talked about it as, you know, these people have, you know, have had candida for a long time, maybe. We'll talk about that. And that has maybe depleted their body of some of the nutrients that are needed for that detoxification. And certainly they have genetic predisposition. But just because you have genetics doesn't mean it's a life sentence. I mean, it is in a way, but we have these epigenetics, which we've talked about a little bit, but I need to go into much more detail about how we can help this population. So stay tuned. We'll stay tuned right here to the Natural Nurse and Dr. Z.
Stay tuned to PRN.FM for more empowering ideas from progressive voices. We're moving forward, and we hope you're coming with us.
Next time on Peace Talks Radio, a lively and thoughtful debate on this question: love or fear? Which motivates us more?
Love creates spaces of safety. When you're loved, you can explore, you can create, you can find things, make things new.
I have a fear that I'm going to be remembered for bad things or that I won't be remembered at all. And that fear drives almost everything that goes on in my life.
That's next time on Peace Talks Radio.
We are PRN. 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 Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned.
And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. I'm Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamperone, naturopathic physician, host of the program, and we have an exciting show talking about chronic inflammatory response syndrome, folks that seem to be the canaries in the coal mine, like Dr. Sackman talked about. And so we want to continue our discussion and talk about maybe more about other evaluations that Dr. Sackman would do to look at these folks. How do we evaluate them? And, you know, what basically can we do for folks like that? Really, I guess it's very individual, but nonetheless, she could tell us with some more interesting patient stories about different manifestations of that. Welcome back. Great
Hi,
to
Dr.
have
Z.
you on again. And let's continue our discussion, our thread on that. So you said there's like many combinations and permutations of these individuals that come in, and you do a lot of individualized medicine because I guess it really depends on the patient's markers that come back positive and other things. But do you find that these people have heavy metals a lot? These people have bad gut flora a lot, or what are you finding? Is there any common thread amongst people that tend to have this chronic inflammatory response syndrome?
That's a great question. First of all, I would say in general, the patient population I'm dealing with are folks who are chronically ill. And by that, what I mean is something happened. There was some event in time where they started to not feel well. And they've kind of taken themselves, you know, maybe they've exhausted their primary and they've gone to a couple of specialists. Some of them have seen several specialists. I've had patients who have exhausted New England. I myself had to go to New Hampshire to find someone to treat me who then trained me. So it was a very fortunate experience for me. But what happens is for this 24% of the population who have this genetic SNP, this variation, and they end up with these biotoxins recirculating and recirculating, it actually becomes the imbalance is not only in the immune system, it becomes an immune endocrine imbalance. The relationship, the tightly tuned relationship between the immune system and the endocrine system start to be negatively impacted. So I see patients who have manifestations like sleep disturbance or chronic pain or GI problems or this prolonged illness. I just haven't felt well since, you know, and it's been a year or 3 years or for some people 10 or 20 years, you know, people who have been dealing with this, you know, for 30 years and it hasn't been diagnosed. And then we kind of have this eureka moment where we start putting the pieces together. They have changes in their cortisol. They have changes in their sex hormones. We see decreases in antidiuretic hormone. It's not at all uncommon that these patients have frequent urination. And all of these things are the kind of downstream effect of not being able, the immune system, the innate immune system, not being able to recognize and efficiently eradicate the mold and then the mycotoxins that are coming from the mold. And you mentioned candida, and I think the same is true. For an HLA patient, it's a greater challenge for the immune system. You know, we all have yeast, and I'm told by Genova that some people can have lots of yeast and be asymptomatic, and some people can have minuscule amounts of yeast and be quite symptomatic. So we know there's a great range there. Patients I'm treating who have SIRS do tend to have more issues with yeast, and we have to be mindful of that. And we can do that, you know, we can watch diet and we can do sometimes specific protocols to address that. But, you know, when you have excess mold circulating in your body and those mycotoxins, it puts you at risk for increased fungal infections that also need to be treated. So the majority of my patients are dealing with GI symptoms, absolutely, and some form of hormonal. And like you said, it's very individualized. It goes from the patient who can't sleep, you know, to the patient who has, you know, reduced sex hormones. But when we go in and do the thorough battery of labs, it's really a pattern that we're looking for. We go in and identify a very specific pattern before we actually render the clinical diagnosis.
Yeah, many years ago I had a woman with chronic rheumatoid arthritis that came to see me. And when I ran different testing, I found that she had lots of fungal markers that were positive. You know, I ran what they call the organic acid test.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And that looked at, you know, the first 10 parts of a, let's say, 80-part test look at the fungus. Yet I tried culturing her sinuses. I tried culturing her bowels. I tried culturing her urine. And I didn't see any growth of yeast until I talked to Dr. Shaw, who asked me, you know, he's one of the creators of one of the organic acid tests that I was using. And he's like, well, what about her lungs? Is she breathing in a lot of these things? So at that point, I had her call a mold specialist. And I actually ran a test that was called Fungatel. And you know, really lit up positive. So, and then it turns out that, you know, because sometimes we don't do house calls on patients anymore. Like, I probably would have spotted the mold a mile away just walking in the place. But turns out that she had had bad floods. She had black mold, and that was the case. Eureka!
Right.
And once she got that properly, you know, they had to tear out a lot of her house, actually replace it and things like that, then, you know, she started to kind of get better. But it was like the mold was the big obstacle to cure. She was like one of these non-responders, you know. It's like, why doesn't the, you know, various protocols that help majority of people with RA and autoimmunity that I've developed over the years, why isn't it working in this lady? What am I missing? So that's kind of an interesting clinical dilemma. You think you kind of stumbled upon this.
Absolutely, absolutely. You know, one of the things I love about this protocol and that Dr. Shoemaker dedicated his life's work to this is that this is a very sequential treatment protocol. So, you know, once the way I think about it, I have a very in-depth intake. And when I read over a patient intake, I already have my radar up. I think I've got a potential CSRS patient here. And at that point, I give them a secondary intake form. They don't know it. It's a list of maybe 50 symptoms. And I say, just, you know, take a highlighter and highlight anything that you've experienced in the last year. They don't know that they are actually filling out the symptoms of a CSRS-related illness. So at that point, I have what I think is a good clinical picture. It's like, okay, I've got a clinical presentation of a picture who's meeting the presentation of a chronic inflammatory response patient. And at that point, I go looking for the exposure. And sometimes that may come up at the end of the interview. My first patient visit is 90 to 120 minutes. It may come up right off the get-go. Every now and again, a patient comes in and knows they're sick because of mold, but that's the exception. But quite often what will happen is as I ask the patient, tell me about where you live, how long have you lived there, when did you start to feel notice that you were sick, where did you live then? Had you recently moved? And that's when we start to hit pay dirt, because the majority of the patients who are ill had either recently moved into the place where the water damage is, or there had been an event in that house. A couple of weeks ago, I had a young woman in chronically ill. Very, you know, I'm dealing with a lot of young people who are chronically ill. It's not, these are not just older people. Mm-hmm. And I said, well, tell me about your house. And she said, oh, it's only 5 years old. And I thought, well, thank goodness I don't have to. Right now, this is not going to be a CSRS patient, because 80% of my practice at this point are probably CSRS patients. And I said, oh, great, 5 years old. I said, you have never had any water damage or anything in the house. And she rolled her eyes. Oh, my gosh, the basement flooded. It's all musty down there. The rug is. And I was like, okay, here we go. So I kind of try very hard. I don't want to be looking through the lens of CSRS all the time. That doesn't keep me objective. I know that. So sometimes I try really hard to put that lens down, and yet I think, you know, this practice is just becoming a CSRS specialty practice. That maybe that was always the intention for me here in Maine, was that I wasn't going to have an autism specialty practice, because all the patients I'm seeing, for the most part, regardless of what they come in with, I am finding they have the clinical presentation. Very quickly, within a first visit, I find the exposure. Occasionally, I'll have a patient who's, no, there's nothing. I'm quite convinced there is. We can get a free consult. And they came back and said, yeah, you know, Eastern mold remediation came in, and you were right, there's mold in the basement. So at that point.
But just because there's mold doesn't mean they're going to get this illness. They have to have all the genetic predispositions and things like that, right? Just to be clear for listeners out there.
Right. Very valid point. What we want to keep in mind is that grossly 50% of the buildings in the United States are water damage buildings. That is a conservative estimate, that 50% of the buildings in the United States are water damage buildings, and 24% of the population has this genetic variation. So when that genetic variation together with 50% of the buildings in the United States being, you know, water damaged, and part of that is old buildings. That makes sense. But also, probably 20, 30 years ago, we went through this era of building where the builders got this concept that they should be doing these water vapors around houses and wrapping them in plastic. And the houses can't breathe. So a lot of the houses that were built, you know, maybe 30, 20 years ago, have these vapor barriers and all these super tight windows, which makes sense for heat, you know, and expensive heat. But those buildings aren't breathing, and some of those buildings are very, very dangerous, and those become some of the exposures that patients have as well.
So do they just call a conventional mold company? Are there different, I guess it depends on your locale, but there are you know, companies that specialize in finding the toxic molds as well?
There are. I think, you know, one of the things I love about being a naturopathic doctor is we see ourselves as educators, as teachers, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things you taught me.
Sure.
So I spend a lot of time educating my patients to become empowered and to go home and look. So, you know, I let them know you present as a patient who could have chronic inflammatory response. you told me you think you saw a leak underneath your trailer. I want you to go home, and I want you to go through the house with a very fine-tooth comb looking for any potential water damage, dampness, mold under your sink, in your bathroom, around your shower, depending on the heat unit, depending on the air conditioner, and certainly we have to call in specialists sometimes. By the time we've gotten there, though, one thing we haven't talked much about is I do want to mention the labs.
Yeah, sure.
Because I think people get concerned thinking about expenses and that kind of thing. And if a patient has, you know, health insurance, I mean, certainly, I don't know if you know this, but in the state of Maine, you know, I'm able to work with insurance providers. I'm paid by Anthem, Aetna, Community Health Options, and Cigna, all reimbursed naturopathic doctors in the state of Maine. So a lot of my patients have and use their insurance, which is fantastic.
Mm-hmm.
And the labs that we use, this is all Dr. Shoemaker's protocol to diagnose SIRS as a very intense battery of tests, but they all have ICD-10 codes and CPT codes, which means that all the primary insurance companies recognize and reimburse these codes.
Wow. Great.
So that's really good news, right?
Absolutely, yeah. Not a lot of out-of-pocket expense for certain people, that's for sure.
Right. If a patient has insurance and the insurance is covering naturopathic medicine, or sometimes I work with other docs, the patient will come to see me. Maybe their insurance won't cover labs if a naturopath orders them, but I will write up back to the doctor. You taught me how to do that, Dr. Z. I write the letter up back to the primary doctor with an explanation of what we're treating and the tests that I'd like to run, and would they consider running them? And the majority of the times they are, because the doctors are very frustrated and they haven't been able to help the patients.
Wonderful, yeah. So now, once you've identified and start working with the patient with SIRS, I guess you have a treatment in mind. What are some of the different treatments that help these folks?
Right. Great question. Well, the number one thing is, believe it or not, living in a mold-free environment. Most important thing to do for a patient who's presenting with this is to get the environment mold-free, and that becomes really tricky. So we then need to know where the source of the mold is. We need to consider the resources of the family. So right. I see this as a very unique situation where I get to know my patients really well. I get to know what their resources are. We need to get really savvy about how we use the resources. What can they do? What can't they do? So, for example, one patient just sold her home that I have.
Wow.
Other people move out and live with somebody else because they can't afford to deal with the house. Other people get really savvy about putting a dehumidifier in the basement.
That even helps just doing that?
It does. It does. You know, getting the moisture content. I mean, mold needs a certain amount of moisture to grow. So getting the moisture content in the home down is a very savvy, very smart thing to do.
Yeah. And I know there's other companies that do those types of things, not that don't have dehumidifier type things, but, you know, but have solutions for that thing. Venting systems, I know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it depends on where the mold is. So one patient who thought she had chronic Lyme, it was mold. I smelled it on her. She went, oh, yeah, this scarf just came out of a basket, and I did see mold on the basket. Where was the basket? Well, they couldn't find mold in the house, in the apartment anywhere. And, you know, I wrote a letter to her landlord letting him know that this was a serious health problem for this woman and something needed to be done. He eventually moved her to a new apartment. But where that basket was sitting when they opened up that wall was black mold all inside that wall.
My parents run different ionizing units down in their cellar where they store some clothes and things like that. They have a nice air. They have fans running, which moves the air. So they've, because my mother is very sensitive to mold, and she's figured out a way. You know, I can go down there in her place and have no problem at all. But in the old days, before she kind of realized that, it was very musty. Most people's basements are a little bit on the musty side.
Well, dehumidification is really helpful. Ozone is great for killing mold. Yeah. You can't be right. in the house while you're running an ozone generator, but I have an ozone generator here that people can borrow and close up a house and ozone the house and then open the house.
Well, there are
up.
Different grades of them, I think. There are some that, you know, you can kind of that give you the amount of ozone that you'd find only in a thunderstorm, for instance, mm-hmm. which mm-hmm. is not too bad. Mm-hmm. But yeah, you're right. Some of the commercial ozone generators that are used to really clean things, yeah, they would be too toxic for mm-hmm. someone to be around.
And a very okay. gentle way of approaching this is with something like thieves' oil. Thieves' oil will actually kill mold. And on YouTube, there is a phenomenal demonstration by Dr. Close, who's an environmental engineer, who shares a wonderful story about doing a rehabilitation of a major, major apartment complex in a big city that no one could figure out how to get it to pass. And they actually go in with thieves' oil, and he shows the before and after of the air quality in relationship to the different molds. The tricky part is, I mean, that will kill the mold. That's fantastic. Killing the mold is fantastic. So we've got ways to do that. We can kill it with thieves oil. We can kill it with ozone. There's, you know, a number of ways to do that. However, what's true for somebody who's super sensitive, who is an HLA variant, who's been exposed a couple times, we will react to the DNA of a dead mold spore.
Yeah.
So there has to be a second step, and that is actually called ammonium chloride, which is in Windex, our 409 cleaner.
Oh.
So I have my patients clean with thieves cleaner. So go in and wipe your walls, wipe your chairs, wipe everything down with the thieves cleaner, and then follow it up with Windex. And that can make a really big difference for a lot of patients as well.
So that gets a lot of the dead part, the spore part, I guess, the inactive spore part, I guess, out.
Yeah, the DNA. It actually,
the DNA. The organism.
Yep. Interesting. Yep. Yeah, so there's a lot we can do to remediate the house, but I say to my patients, you know, if I have a, I don't really like using the word sick, but it's like, my job is to help you get well, but your house is sick. So my job needs to be to help you get your house well so I can get you well.
Yeah.
So we got to take the house, too.
So then what about the patient? Like, so now they've taken care of the house, can mm-hmm. you augment the patient's ability to, keeping in mind that I know they have this epigenetic struggle.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So are there things that they can do to help them?
I want to be really clear. This is a treatable condition. This is a treatable condition. Yeah, absolutely. I know we've been doing a lot of dooming and glooming about this, but this is a treatable condition. That's the good news. So you're right. It depends on the patient. It depends on what I get back for labs. But number one, we're working to get you in a mold-free environment. Number two, we put you on a binder. So remember, we're recycling and recirculating these molds and the biotoxins. So Dr. Shoemaker's protocol is about using cholestyramine, which is CSM. It's referred to as CSM. Cholestyramine is a prescription that's actually an anti-lipid cholesterol-lowering medication. And it actually grabs these fat-soluble toxins. It's a bit of a challenging product for some people because it has some food coloring and sugar in it. So there's a compounding pharmacy in Massachusetts where we have that compounded into a really clean product. And there's actually other ways. Some people can do okay with charcoal. Some people can do okay with something called chitosan, which is made of shellfish. So the key is that we get you on a binder and that binder is being used to absorb these fat-soluble toxins. And probably the next step that's important, and you mentioned it earlier, is a nasal swab. Most people who have this chronic inflammatory response syndrome have a staph growing in their sinus cavities. And so identifying that, and there's a specific lab in Massachusetts called Micrometrics DX that does this Marcon's testing. So I do a swab on all my patients, and they may be asymptomatic. Most chronic inflammatory response patients who have pain or difficulty sleeping or frequent urination or, you know, long-term illness do not complain necessarily about their sinuses, but they do have this staph growing in their sinuses. And once we treat that, it makes a world of difference because the staph in the sinuses is also creating these neurotoxins. So for myself, for example, as soon as I went on the antibiotic spray with EDTA in it, which broke down the biofilm and treated the staph infection. No more headaches, no more dizziness, no more brain fog. You know, it was incredible. It was just incredible. It was a huge turning point for me in my own recovery.
Have they found a type of strep, too, that may be a problem besides the staph? Because it's interesting. I find that some folks have a very high strep titer, but I can't find the strep anywhere. You know, it's interesting.
I haven't seen it yet.
Okay.
I'm doing a lot of these. Mostly everything I'm seeing is some form of staph. And the one that we see typically is this multi-antibiotic resistant coagulative negative, which is what the Marcon stands for. And, you know, I do a lot of treatment with colloidal silver and some kind of xylitol spray. Sometimes we can get it that way, but unfortunately a fair amount of the time folks are, I don't know why I say unfortunately, because it works well, but we do need to go to the antibiotic spray, which we have compounded out of state as well.
Oh.
And it's called Beg Spray, BEG. It's two antibiotics with an EDTA, and it's a two-month treatment protocol, and it's working extremely, extremely well for a number of my folks. Yeah. And then it depends, you know, Dr. Z, it depends on the marker. So, for example, one of the cytokines I test is TGF-beta-1, which is a marker of inflammation. If that is elevated, we use a lot of curcumin and a lot of resveratrol. If MMP9 is elevated, which is another marker that I test, we put folks on a low-starch diet, a low-amylose diet, a low-sugar diet, and a very high-quantity, high-quality fish oil. And so depending, again, on what the markers are, we go in and try to start rebalancing these various markers to achieve decreased inflammation. And then eventually, ultimately, everything is leading to a nasal spray called vasoactive intestinal peptide. And once you get to that step, it's really resetting the immune endocrine system. So that's kind of the last step in the process, is getting there.
Wow.
And hopefully doing a major reset to the entire system. So I really want people to understand that it's important to be informed about this, to be savvy about this, because the good news is there's so much you can do for this. And I'm seeing people in 3 to 4 months go from being chronically ill to feeling really, really good.
How can folks contact you?
Well, we're up here in Maine, and my website is about to be launched. And, of course, we're MaineNaturalMedicine.com. You'll find references to us on the internet, but the website will be challenging to find still for about a month. And the number here is 207-664-0005. I have a wonderful, wonderful office manager whose name is Lois, and she's very savvy and happy to answer any questions.
Well, thanks. This has been just totally new stuff for many of us, and including myself. So I appreciate going back to school, and it's great to when my students can teach me stuff. That's what it's all about. Thank you so much, Dr. Sackman.
Thank you, Dr. Z. It's been such an honor to have the privilege to work with you. I miss you a lot. Hope I'll see you soon at a conference.
Okay. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. You can always get more information about what we're doing at naturalnurse.com or drznaturally.com. Stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.